Welcome to the Passive with Property podcast, hosted by Dragan Domofsky and co-host Amanda Calabria. With over two decades of property investing, Dragan is a qualified property investment advisor and buyer's agent. We're committed to the education of both first-time and seasoned investors in property investment and wealth creation. The Passive with Property podcast is brought to you by The Buyers Agency Australia.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dragan Domofsky, your host. And today, as always, we have the lovely Amanda Calabria as the co-host. Amanda.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
No problem. Thanks for being here, as always. Today, we'll be discussing wins and losses. So we're going to go through our own personal wins and losses. So Amanda, you know, let's get started with yourself.
All right. Should we start with the good, the bad, or the ugly?
Let's start with the bad.
Bad one first.
Let's do a bad.
Okay. All right. Well, look, bad property investment decisions come from a few different places, right? They can come from bad advice, bad timing, bad judgment, bad due diligence. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of factors that have to happen for a bad decision to be made. And in my case, a lot of them were actually instances where I didn't back myself. And I've got one example, if you want the bad first.
Let's do it.
I've got one example that still eats at me. I'm very bad at letting go of things. Mm-hmm. I tend to hold on to them. And this one, I still bring it up because I was right. And sometimes you need the win in the loss. Mm-hmm. So this one was a property that I had purchased before I was married and before I met my husband. So for those listeners that have been listening to other episodes of our podcast will know that a lot of my influence came from my dad or my family. Mm-hmm. And in my earlier investment years, I tended to default to a lot of their views or advice while I grew my confidence and grew my knowledge and grew my ability to be more independent with my property investing from a mindset perspective. I was always obviously financially independent, but a lot of decision-making, I would, you know, talk to mum and dad or talk to family members, and I would assume because they were older and wiser that they were always correct. Even if I felt differently, I would convince myself that I was the one that was wrong because I was younger and newer at this. What I didn't realize at the time was that I was far more obsessed and passionate about it. For them, it was a means to an end. For me, it was a genuine passion. So even though I was a generation younger or had different views, they were no less valid. Mm-hmm. So for me, my first mistake was that I had a property that I had purchased before I was married, and then the area that it was in underwent massive gentrification and redevelopment. Mm-hmm. So the local council in that area had announced a new rail, new all sorts of, they were basically redeveloping the entire area. And the property that I owned was a much older property, but everything around it was being bought out by developers and replaced with brand new high rise, brand new this, brand new that, brand new everything. And my gut feeling said to me that the property that I had, because it hadn't been bought out by developers and it was sort of the ugly duckling area, like the ugly duckling pocket that had been left behind, my gut feeling was to sell it before the flood of new stock and all those completions on those house and land packages finished, because I was worried the area was going to be flooded, that there was too much development. And if you don't own the new and shiny thing in that area, then it would be devalued by the oversupply. Mm-hmm. So I remember talking to my dad, and by this point I was married, and talking to Stephen, and I said, I really think we should sell this property. And dad said to me, are you insane? The area's getting redeveloped. Like, you got in early. This is great. Mm. And I'm going, nah, dad, there's oversupply. My gut's telling me to sell. And I remember talking to the property manager at the time because the tenant had moved out and there was a gap. And I'm like, I could renovate and flog it and be done before all this development finishes.
And let me guess, he was pushing you to sell it so he can get his commission?
Actually, no. He no. said the same thing as my dad. Wow. He said, hold on to it. There's going to be massive growth.
That's a good agent.
Yeah, well, yeah, I suppose, because he wasn't looking for the sales commission. Mm. But at the same time, I sort of said to him, like, I really think I should sell. Mm-hmm. And he remembers this conversation because I still give him heat about it too. I still go, remember when you told me not to sell? And he goes, yes, I remember.
So hang on, you're blaming him.
I blame everyone but myself. I'm a millennial.
That's funny.
I'm a millennial. I blame everyone but myself.
So even though he told you not to sell, you were blaming him for...
I should have sold.
You should have.
I should have sold because...
Oh, hang on, you should have sold.
Yes.
Oh,
this is the mistake.
So you held on to it. Sorry, I don't know this story.
You finish the story and you'll see. You will see the enormity of this mistake.
Okay.
So this is me doing what I do best. I seek validation when I doubt myself, right? Because I said the mistake was that I didn't back myself.
Mm-hmm.
So because I didn't back myself, I was doubting myself. I looked for validation. I didn't get it from my dad. Mm-hmm. I didn't get it from the property manager and I didn't get it from Stephen.
Sure.
So I decided to hold.
Okay.
I actually refinanced. I remember going to the bank and even the bank, I remember this conversation because we had a personal banker at the time and I would ring her and just ask for what I wanted because she was our contact at the bank. And I said to her, I'm not going to sell it. I'm going to refinance it. And she goes, oh, okay, what value do you want on it? And I just inflated some stupid number and said, I'll value it at this.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, I'll see what I can do. And then they came back at that value, even though I had inflated it, because even the bank was pricing in growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, okay, I'm clearly wrong because if the bank is lending at this inflated value, I'm the idiot here.
Mm.
And I had thoroughly convinced myself I was wrong. So I kept this property. And then, of course, the prices in that area on the older stock nosedived because everybody wanted their brand new shiny house and land packages, which were oversupplied and selling at a discount because of all the supply on the new stuff. The old stuff didn't stand a chance because people were getting discounts on the new stuff.
Yep.
We ended up selling that property for $50,000 less than what I would have got
mm-hmm.
when I wanted to sell it. And we only sold it 18 months later.
That's what I was going to say. How long?
How much time?
Yeah.
It was 18 months
mm-hmm.
when they finally admitted I was right all along.
Mm-hmm.
And I still hold them to it because the mistake was not backing myself.
So that's the $50,000 from the purchase price and the sold,
putting in. I still made money on it because I held it for so long.
Yeah.
But I could have sold it for $50,000 more if I sold it when I wanted to.
Understood.
Okay. So they all cost me $50,000.
Okay.
I couldn't go after them for it, could I?
Wow.
So I blame them, but also blame myself for not backing myself. So there's a moral lesson there. And the problem I had was I couldn't articulate an argument for why I was right. It was a gut feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I could see all the high rise and I went, nah, this isn't good.
Okay.
But I couldn't articulate why.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think now, 10 years later, I probably could.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Mm. Well, one of my losses was it wasn't really a loss. It was something I could have just made. You probably already know this, the little duplex that I had a land down in Ulladulla.
Okay.
Purchased just before COVID and was literally a few months before COVID hit in 2008. I forgot when COVID was.
COVID was March 2020.
Okay. So just before then, I purchased a block of land in the plans in an area called Ulladulla,
yeah.
which is the south coast of New South Wales. It's about 4-hour drive south of Sydney. I purchased this block of land cheap and... I'm going to keep this story short, okay?
Why? What are you not going to say?
The plan was that I was going to build a duplex. Mm. It was going to take about, worst case, 18 months, okay, and then sell them off and make roughly about, 100 to 150K profits after all expenses.
Mm.
Now, I held on to that block of land. COVID came along, and we all know that building – all the builders went increased with the pricing and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It was very slow to get approvals going through to actually find a proper builder to get them with the works happening and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, eventually it took about 2.5 years to get it built. I could have sold that block of land within 12 months and made the same profit that I had after all the trouble of building, holding, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So that, call it a loss in one way because I could have had, the funds come in quicker and moved on to the next project.
Yeah. We've talked about that in podcasts, interference.
Yeah, we have.
That's a big topic.
Yeah. So that was one of my losses. Yeah. And look, it was a learning process as well. It's an experience, but you got to question sometimes do I sell quick and just take the yeah. you know, the gain, the profits, or am I going to take the further steps and potentially get more or break it even from the profit I could have had?
Yeah.
You know, just by doing it sooner.
Yeah.
So that's what happened to me. And yes, during that process within within COVID, there was a lot of stress as well.
Mm.
You know, so.
Particularly with building sites being shut down, prices going up.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, so there was. And the increase in price, I mean, I was lucky. I was one of the lucky ones that I only got a 20% increase on, you know, the materials, where I've heard ugly stories where up to 50, 60% increase you know, within that. And obviously some builders have gone bust and left people, you know, high and dry on half-built projects, which is scary. So, but yeah, that's my one of my losses.
Actually, it's interesting you mentioned where builders have left people high and dry. I've got a story. It's not mine. It's a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. But he bought a house and land package from a developer. I think it was around that COVID timing, probably similar timing, because I know the build costs went up during his contract period. And the developer actually approached him and asked for another $70,000 on top of the fixed price contract.
Yep.
And said, we can't afford to finish your build because our margin's completely gone. Mm-hmm. You can either pay the $70,000 or we can rescind the contract. Now, people that didn't know their rights went, well, I don't have $70,000, so I'll rescind. You know, and the developers were pitching it as a, you know, no consequence rescission. You know, we'll let you rescind without consequence. You go your way, we'll go our way. We won't chase you for money. You don't chase us for anything. Mm. What people didn't realize was their rights. And I can only speak for New South Wales and the Supreme Court of New South Wales, where you can't actually, one party can't actually rescind an off-the-plan contract in that manner. It has to be a mutual rescission. Now, the way these developers were getting away with it was that they were presenting it as mutual by giving the purchaser a choice, pay the $70,000 or rescind. So the purchaser thought they had a choice. I can buck up the money or I can cancel the contract. But what these people didn't realise was that they were well within their rights to hold the developer to the original contract, because there was nothing invalid about the original contract.
Mm-hmm.
So the grounds for mutual rescission that the developers were presenting weren't actually valid. But people didn't know their rights, and people felt a sense of relief at being offered the exits that they took them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened to a mate of mine, and it's not my story to tell, so I won't tell the rest of it, but it became quite a dispute, because a lot of purchasers in these situations as well were in a bit of a bind, because interest rates were going up as well. So there were concerns about finance at completion. There were concerns about, you know, not just building costs, but builder quality. You know, if you hold the builder to the contract and you know they're building on a zero margin contract, well, what shortcuts are they going to take in that build to make up for it if you haven't paid the $70,000?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Yep.
So it put people in a very, very difficult situation. And this is the inherent risk when you buy off the plan. There are so many factors that you can't control on a product that you can't see.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so not my story, but a lot of people got caught up in that sort of thing as well.
Yeah. Look, this is why when I do builds, I always like to actually get an external project manager to come in and do all the checks from the actual contract. And so there's no shortcuts.
This is where I get a bit funny with build contracts, right? Because, again, the banks kind of stuff people up. We're deviating now, and I apologize.
That's right.
But the banks kind of stuff people up as well, because banks require a fixed price contract for a construction loan.
Yep.
Now, a fixed price contract in the bank's eyes is a risk mitigation strategy, in the sense that if it's a fixed price and they can forecast the end value, then they know that the asset they're lending against isn't going to overcapitalize the value of the loan, right? So when people build, they want their fixed price contract for the bank and also for their own peace of mind. I know this is what I'm going to spend.
Yep.
But the fixed price contract is actually a trap, for the very reasons we said. If prices go up, builder expenses go up, then builder shortcuts have to increase to preserve their margin.
Yep.
So when I build, and I fully acknowledge that this is not available to everybody and not every builder will do it, but I actually like what's called a cost plus contract.
Yep.
So a cost plus contract is where you don't have to decide everything up front, your colours, your finishes, your colours and your finishes you do, because council needs those for the DA, but your finishes and your fixtures, you don't need to decide up front on a cost plus contract. How it works instead is you work with your builder, and they will source, you know, quotes and whatever from their trades, And the way it works is you actually negotiate a margin with your builder. Mm-hmm. So it might be 15, 20, 30%. You pay the invoice directly to the trade, and then you pay, say, the 20% margin to the builder. So what that does is it stops builders, I suppose, playing around with the numbers, because you're paying the invoices directly and you're just paying the builder the management fee. Mm-hmm. So on a fixed price contract, the builder has to bake in contingency, because if there's a delay with the plumber, or this gets missed, or it rains for a month or whatever, they have to price all of that in to a fixed price contract. On a cost plus contract, you're paying for things as they get done. You're looking at the quotes before the job. You're having a say in the trades, in the scope of work. You can make, you know, within a degree of reason, changes to finishes and fixtures. And you're actually working more collaboratively with the builder.
Yep.
With that said, a bank won't lend on that type of contract, because it's risky for them. If you overspend or get carried away with that build, and then you spend more than the property is worth, then that's not a risk-free asset for the bank to lend against.
Yep.
So it's a bit of a no-win situation, because you have to either be cash funded to build cost plus and find a builder that will do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then if you go fixed price contract, you're paying for things you may never need, because the builders had to bake them in.
That's right, put them in. But also what I find, especially when it comes to clients, people who are beginning, not only necessarily our clients, but there's, our clients or clients of builders, or people I know who are at the beginning stages of building a property. You know, they've had their few investment properties. Now they're into that stage of building.
Yeah.
They actually love the idea of fixed cost, because we know what it's going to cost. We can budget from there, but that's not...
It's not necessarily the cheaper outcome.
The cheaper or the better option, right?
Yeah.
So you probably want to delve into that a little.
Yeah, I fear a fixed price contract, simply because you don't know what contingencies have baked in, and when those contingencies and margins get eaten up, what shortcuts the builder is then going to take.
Exactly, yeah.
That's why they scare me, because, again, lack of control. Maybe I'm a control freak, but when...
Maybe.
Sorry. Just a little bit. But as an investor, you kind of have to keep control, because it's your money and your risk.
Yep.
As much as you can hire a builder and hire a project manager or hire a building inspector, at the end of the day, they're not the one taking on the risk.
Yep.
It's not their expense. It's not their borrowing capacity. It's not their risk profile, and it's not their credit score.
Yep.
So for me, I didn't start building and developing until I could do it with cash, because I feared fixed price contracts. I feared builders having too much control. I feared being locked in. Mm-hmm. I feared shortcuts, you know, particularly over COVID. A lot of people that held their builders to those contracts, the builders had to make their money or they folded.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So for me, a cost plus contract keeps me in control. I can walk away at any time and not lose anything. I've only paid for the work that's been done.
Yeah.
I've had a say in the quote. I've seen the original invoice from the original tradie, because it's come direct to me. I've just paid the margin to the builder directly. But like I said, the banks stop people doing this because they won't lend on those type of contracts.
Okay.
So it's a no-win situation for your average investor. And now a lot of laws have changed, because the lending doesn't protect the consumer. The law has had to change to protect the consumer. So now we have, you know, your six-year builder's warranties and so on. You have all of these consumer protections. The builders now have to bake in those prices as well.
Yeah.
So builders are actually, unless they're a volume builder like your McDonald Jones and your Beechwood Homes and all those big ones, for a private custom home, or, you know, smaller builder, which an investor would probably prefer to use, because we're not building project homes.
Yeah.
We're building often custom dual keys and all of that. It stops those builders from actually being able to turn a genuine profit, because the law has interfered to such a degree and let the lenders off the hook for different types of contracts to such a degree that it's made the whole thing unviable for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Builders aren't profiting, developers aren't profiting unless they're shortcutting. People that are buying the end product, the house and land packages, are definitely not profiting, because they're getting an inferior product.
Yeah.
So nobody wins.
Yeah. Okay. So for the listeners out there, explain why, I mean, let's go through the difference. Why would they use, say, a private builder from a, you know, the
you're going to make me say the word control again, aren't you?
Okay, there is control, but then also, you know, there is that thing that, okay, well, you know, your Masterton Homes or your Hotonda Homes, they're a big organization, and there's some security as well. You know, we hear the stories that the smaller builders go under, and then again, like I said before, you're left with a half, you know, a half cooked project.
I think regardless of whether you go with a bigger builder or a smaller builder, you've got to do your due diligence, because there's advantages and disadvantages to both.
Yeah,
with your volume builders, yes, you have economies of scale, and they're financially potentially more stable, but at the same time, they're less flexible with floor plan changes. You know, unless your block of land perfectly suits one of their existing designs, they'll often charge you extras. And where builders make their margin is on variations. So every time you make a variation to something that is their standard, you're charged extra at an inflated rate.
Yep.
So they'll drill down the base price, but drill up the upgrades and varies.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you get halfway through and you go, oh, you know what? There's not enough power points in this house. Call the Sparky back and add in some more. Bang, you get slapped with a vary.
Yep.
So I think for a volume builder, especially when you've got a fixed price contract, to make any variations to that fixed price contract, that's where they get you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a smaller builder, hopefully, they're still going to make their money, but hopefully you build a better relationship with them because you're not being passed from, you know, their sales team to their design team to their project manager. You know, you're not being passed on. You're dealing with either the owner or the project manager of that company, and it's a lot smaller, and with that comes more accountability too, and reputation and all the rest. So there's pros and cons both ways. I would say, though, unless you're really friendly with a particular builder, like if it's a friend or family member, and I know, you know, you shouldn't mix business with pleasure, but unless it's a really trusted builder, relying on a builder for a development where every day costs you money and every dollar costs you your profit, your relationship with your builder needs to be absolutely gap-free.
Yep. Okay.
And with a volume builder, that's hard to do.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that, Amanda. Now, let's get into the win.
Yeah, can we talk about the good stuff?
Let's go. Let's be positive. Let's finish off with a positive.
Yeah.
All right. Go for it.
I've got a few wins because I did a bit of brainstorming before we came in today, and there's a few wins. A lot of them, again, are timing, some intentional, some not so. One, I'm actually going to mention, I could go for luck. Will I go for the luck one? This one.
What's the option? So you've got...
So I've got one where a subdivision did better than expected, but I suppose that's not applicable to everyone. Another one where we nearly got stuck holding a bag on a lemon but managed to sell it through circumstances. No, I'll go with the luck one because it's a cool little win.
All right, let's go.
So we had this house in a growing area, and it was a really good house, big block of land, and we'd renovated it. We rejigged the floor plan, opened it up, really modernized this home, and it was absolutely beautiful. And the timing of us selling it, the market was sort of in a bit of a dipper, but we needed to sell this property because it was our owner-occupier at the time and I didn't want to pay capital gains tax and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like, we're better off selling it than holding it because you wait for a better market, you pay that in capital gains tax anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, we'll just sell it in this little dipper. But what happened was there was just by coincidence a rate drop in the – or was it a rate drop or a rate hold? I think rates were rising and they held – whatever happened, a whole bunch of people went for their pre-approvals because there was like this weird little jump in the market. So by the time we actually put it on the market, got to the auction and sold, there was like this burst of flurry, you know, whatever in the market. And we happened to sell right at the end of the 3 months after that rate – I think it was a rate halt was announced. So people's pre-approvals were about to expire. Another rate rise was predicted, so they wanted to buy before the end of this 3 months. And our auction landed, I think, in the last 3 weeks of that 3 months. So the market was really buoyant. The agent was pumping us up. He was like, I think you guys are going to break a suburb record. Like, I don't want to count chickens, but the interest I've had is really good. And we're thinking, oh, yeah, right, mate, whatever you say.
Mm.
And it was good. And then he comes to us 2 weeks before the auction. And coincidentally, I had just come out of this massive surgery. So I was not feeling good. And he came to us and he said, I think you should bring your auction forward a week. We've got a lot of momentum. And I just said, no, like I came out of surgery yesterday. I cannot do an auction next weekend. The week after, leave it where it is. And he said, I really think you should bring it forward a week. And I was not buddy-buddy with the auctioneer, but I trusted the auctioneer. So I rang the auctioneer and I said, what do you think? You know, you don't get a commission. You're a flat fee. What do you think? And he said, bring it forward. The market's hot.
Okay.
And I thought, okay. And he said, the advantage of your property, you know, big block of land, renovated, you know, people just move in, don't have to lift a finger. The new hospital's been announced down the road. There was a hospital and there was all this flurry about where's the hospital site. They just announced the hospital site and we were right near it. And he said, bring the auction forward. And I thought, okay. So I agreed to bring the auction forward and I hobbled into this, you know, looked like death warmed up, but I did this auction. We broke the suburb record the week after, which was the week in between the two auction dates, They shelved the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. So had we gone
timing.
To auction.
Timing. Yeah. That is luck.
Had we gone to, and I threw a tantrum. I was like, how dare you two men, you know, male real estate agent, male, I'm a female. I've just had this big suit. I've just, you know, I was postpartum by like a matter of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had another surgery after my C-section. And I was like, how dare you bully me into bringing my auction forward and rah. And then the hospital got shelved and then they both turned on me and went. So that
I'm sure, like, I'm sure you would have found some way that we were right there.
No, they were right. I'll give them. And I you know what? We actually got nice friendships out of it. I'm still friends with both of them because, I was wrong. So that was a good bit of luck because then all those pre-approvals expired, the hospital got shelved and the market flatlined again. So we offloaded right at the top.
That's
right at the top. And broke the suburb record. Yeah.
That's great. Congrats.
Mm. So the hospital's back on and it's still the same site, but it got shelved. I think it was like a 6 or 12 week. There was like a local or state government election and they were arguing like, we're going to shelve it. But it's back on now. So it's fine.
Okay. Amazing. Mm. All right. My turn.
Yeah.
My turn. A win. Well, let me see. One of my wins is something that I'm actually working on at the moment.
Ooh, a current win.
Okay, current win.
Don't jinx it though. Are you counting chickens or are we already winning?
No, it's already winning.
Okay.
It's already winning.
Let's hear it.
So it's a property that just, look, it's one of those things where I was sitting down on a Saturday morning and I'm thinking, you know what? I'm at a stage in life where I don't have to be working weekends.
Yeah.
And I'm staring at my computer at 6 in the morning, having my coffee and I'm going, you know what? I'm just going to pick up the laptop. No, it was 7 in the morning. Sorry. I remember now.
Be accurate.
Got to be accurate. And I open up the laptop and I go, let's do some searches, you know, maybe for a client, maybe for myself. We'll see.
Yeah.
You know, I've got one particular property in mind that I've been searching for the last 3 weeks because I've got my pre-approvals. And it just happened that one popped up. It was exactly what I'm after.
Oh.
Okay. So it was one of those, up in Queensland. It was one of those, Queensland, in Brisbane, high set type properties. And I'm looking at it, and I won't mention the price or anything, but I'm looking at it and I go, that seems a little cheap. Okay. And done the search, I've done the due diligence. I could be under a flood zone. Let's get that checked out. So I did check it out and I'm like, no, it's not. It's actually pretty far from any flooding in that area. High set. They had 3 bedrooms downstairs, kitchenette already done, bathroom, and the same upstairs.
Okay.
So I'm thinking in total it's a 6 bedroom, yeah. 2 bathroom, 2 kitchens, well, 1 major kitchen, 1 smaller kitchenette downstairs.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, it might actually not be legal height downstairs to, you know, to actually.
So we're in Queensland, we're talking.
In Brisbane, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's sitting on a 1,335 square meter block.
Wow.
Now, anyone that knows this particular council, they've had a shift from 1,000 to 1,200 for them to be subdivided. And then I jumped on the phone straight away, well, you know, 9 o'clock, and I call the agent up and I'm discussing with the agent. I said, tell me a little bit about the property. What's up with it? What's the reason for sale? And they said, look, investors, they've had it for about 35 years. And they put it on the market earlier in the year. They weren't too sure about selling it, but now they have to sell.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, is it legal height downstairs? Yes, it is. I said, okay, great. And is there any issues with the property? They said, actually, no, I told them to sell it for about 100 grand more, but they needed it sold ASAP.
Right.
So it was just perfect timing. And I said, all right, you know what? Send me the contract straight away and let me have a little sticky beak through the contract. And I started calling all my agent friends. I said, what do you think the value of this property? Any issues? What do you think of the street? And I went from one to three agents. And they said, well, we think the value is around there. And they're all hovering around that, you know, 80 to about 100, 110 grand more than what they wanted. And I said, can we sign the contract if it's, you know, on the asking price? And I was cheeky. I sent an offer, a formal offer, 10 grand less, and they accepted it. So
there you go.
But what this property is I'm going to spend a little bit of money, maybe 50K. I'm going to put a water meter, electrical, separate upstairs and downstairs, and actually get a 6% return
on
both sides.
Yeah.
Right. Now, on top of that, and for a lot of listeners out there, they know the strategy that I absolutely love is throw another house at the back that has four bedroom, four ensuite, slightly larger, and rent them out as co-living. So that's going to have a nice, almost a 9% rental return. So that's one of my likes that I'm working on at the moment.
Mm.
It's not as glorious as your story, but... It's,
different goal though.
It's a win. That's a recent one that I'm talking. But what I'm actually going to do is once I have this property finalized and settled, I actually will share the actual address and the story.
As a case study.
As a case study.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. So that's one of my wins now.
Very good.
Yeah.
I love a good win.
That's an awesome one.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I didn't actually have it for a client that I could pass it on to. But usually, you know, I've had a couple of really good, what I'd call losses and wins at the same time.
They balance out.
What I'm saying is they're absolute cracker wins, but then I had a client for them and I'm like, okay, I'll have to pass it on to a client. But like, oh, one was a few years ago. I'm trying to remember his name. He actually was, he actually got featured on one of the papers, on the media. We gave him 150K under market value.
Wow.
And I'm like, that could have been mine.
Yeah. But no, you got to put bread on your table. You got to keep your clients happy.
Yeah, of course. But that was a great, that was a what I call a win for my client, you know. But and there's going to be plenty of those coming up. Properties and opportunities like that are always there.
Yeah,
it's just you have to be there constantly.
As I say, the deal of the century comes around once a week. You just got to catch it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So, Amanda, so since we're a little short on time, we're going to split this next one up. You're going to do a win and I'll do a loss, but that became a win and I'll explain why after your story.
Look at that suspense.
All right. Here we go.
Okay, a win. Let me pick a win. Okay. All right. I'll go with... I was going to go with one, but now I'm thinking I might go with another. I don't know. One of them is a win at purchase. One of them is a win at sale. Okay, I might go with the purchase. So we had at the time we were looking for a development site, whether it was a subdivision or a knockdown rebuild, just something that we could value add because the market at the time was quite flat.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd narrowed it down to two properties. One of them was a knockdown rebuild on a street where a lot of knockdown rebuilds had already been done, but this house was in very original condition. It was almost unlivable, so it was selling for land value. And that was option A. Option B was a subdivision site. It was a corner block, and I could get four dwellings onto it. So cut it in half and put a duplex on each side to create four dwellings. Now, Stephen and I were on different teams here. I wanted the knockdown rebuild. He wanted the subdivision. The knockdown rebuild was a deceased estate, so it had to go to auction, and it was going to auction whatever weekend it was. So we used that auction as the deadline to negotiate with the agent on the subdivision site and said, if you don't do a deal with us, if you don't close this deal by the time that auction rolls around, we're going to that auction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, and this is me outing myself as possibly unethical, but when we went to the open home for the subdivision site, because it wasn't my preferred option, I was batting for the other one, I didn't take the open home as seriously as I should have.
Mm-hmm.
So Stephen and I have this thing, because we're still young enough to get away with it, we have this routine and I'm now outing myself. But when we were young enough to get away, and at the time I was heavily pregnant, so it was a very plausible cover story, we acted like first home buyers. And the roles we play is he's the controlling, financially literate husband.
Yep.
I'm the dumb and nervous wife.
Yeah, I've heard this story.
I've told you this. Yeah. So what we do is we divide and conquer. He talks to the main agent. I target the junior. And he talks, you know, keeps the main agent out of the way because the junior's always got loose lips. They're normally young, 20, 21 years old, and they like to show off how much they know about property.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking to this young girl. I still remember her name. It was Jess, and I feel terrible because she was so lovely. And I'm there 8 months pregnant going, oh, you know, I'm about to go on maternity leave. We're going to lose my income. I just don't know if we can afford this. And, you know, it was a subdivision site, so it was a massive block. And I go, but I love the big backyard for the kids. I had no intention of ever living there. But I was like, I just losing my income. I'm really nervous and I'm scared and I just don't know what to do. And my husband's like, we'll be fine. And I'm like, he's just a bit of a cowboy sometimes. And meanwhile, Stephen's just distracting, you know,
the senior agent. Yeah.
And this Jess girl goes, look, I'll let you in on a secret. The main agent, I nearly said his name then. The main agent was trying to break the suburb record for this subdivision site because the suburb has a few subdivision sites remaining. And he wanted to get more listings of those. And she goes, he's trying to list other ones by getting a good price on this one, but the vendor doesn't care. They just want to offload it. So he's listed it. I think he was listing it for 1.6, but guiding us at 1.7.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, the vendor only wants 1470. That's his number, 1470.
Oh, well, okay.
And I was like,
thanks.
Really? And the vendor's not watching this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh. And I went, oh, I still don't think we can afford that. I'm like, 1.2, you know? I'm just so nervous. Anyway, we get back in the car and Stephen goes, nah, he won't take anything less than 1.7. I go, offer 1470.
Mm-hmm.
So we put the offer in at 1470 and this other auction was approaching and the agent laughed at us. The main agent was like, 1470, that's a low ball. We're not taking it. And I go, okay, cool. We'll go to the other auction. No worries. Stephen starts getting nervous. He's like, just pay more, you know. Why are you lowballing? It's because you want the other one, isn't it? And we have all these domestics. Like, you're just saying that because you want the other property. And I'm like, no, Stephen, the junior agent said 1470. So we hung on. It was a game of chicken because he knew the other auction was coming, but he thought we were bluffing. Stephen thought he was, you know, the junior agent had no idea at 1470. So everyone's just at this Mexican standoff. 5 p.m. Friday before the other auction, he goes, all right, we'll take the 1470.
Ah, there you go.
So that was
That's a good win.
That was a good win. But it was only because there were no other buyers and that junior agent had very loose lips. And
yeah.
Yeah, so that strategy works. So for anyone out there, if you're young enough to get away with being first home buyers, nervous Nelly wife, and you can separate the senior and the junior agent and get them alone,
yep.
You'll get good info out of the junior. If you act like you're dumb, they'll want to show you how smart they are,
yep.
And they'll tell you way too much.
Okay.
It works every time.
Amazing.
And I'm really good at acting dumb. So it doesn't take too much for me.
Oh, that's funny. All right. So one of my losses now.
The one that turned into a win.
That turned into a win.
Turn that bus around.
Okay. I don't think I've told you this one. It's a property in Camperdown in Sydney. So it's you know, the inner suburbs of Sydney in the inner west. It was a terrace house that I purchased, a lovely big four-bedroom, double-frontage type of terrace house, you know, double-lock-up garage. This was, it was just before moving to Dubai, okay, with the family. Actually, my second child was born, wasn't born in the house, but literally two streets up from near the hospital at Camperdown Hospital. But anyway, so that's another funny story. Ivana was actually pregnant in labor while there was a renovation going on.
Oh, wow.
In the house. She'll tell you the story one day. But anyway, we got it at a really good price and, it was one of those things we were planning to live there long term, but it never eventuated because change of plans. We ended up moving to Dubai for a few years.
Yeah.
But going back, I found it was run down, you know, it was, you know, brought the family in. This is how much it's going to cost to get renovation. We spent good money to get good quality renovation, you know, marble, Italian tiles, all that sort of German appliances, the whole, you know, bells and whistles. So what happened after that, once it was finished, we lived in it for a little while and I would say it was probably about 8 months and then we were packing to go to, well, we're actually going to move to my parents and then, you know, a month or two later, fly over to Dubai.
So you would have had a newborn or a baby through this.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
So anyway, so where the loss happened was it was a great opportunity, you know, and I'll tell you, back then we purchased for around $1 million. So this is a, you know, right now that property is worth close to three. Okay. And what's that, about 13, 14 years now? Yeah. 13, 14 years. So that's, it's a very good increase in gains there, right? For that property. And where I guess the loss was not listening to one of my uncles, who's also a long-term property investor slash small developer. He says, you're in a perfect location. You're moving to Dubai. Don't sell it. Sure, you're going to make a few hundred K, but just get it rented out.
Mm.
And we were sort of, we had a few things going on.
Yeah.
And I felt uncomfortable of renting it out and then having this, you know, monthly losses. We're moving to another country. There's more, you know, costs involved. Anyway, whatever the...
Would you have qualified for the six-year rule though?
No. The idea where my uncle came into this, he said, look, you can turn this place into six bedrooms and get it co-living. So not only you won't have a loss, you'll actually have a gain. Okay, you're right. Literally walking 5 minute walking, 5 minute walking distance to the hospital.
Yeah.
5 minute walking to Newtown.
Yeah.
5 minute walking to Sydney University.
Yeah.
And you've got all the other universities. You know, 15 minute walk to UTS. You're close to the city. You know, 15 minute bus ride to the city. And I'm thinking, no. You know, this is all nice, and you know. It's renovated to a high standard. I think we'll get a good, a good sale.
Yeah.
It wasn't the best of sale. You know, we didn't make that much from it. It was okay.
Yeah.
But having to listen to my uncle back then and say, hey, you know what, throw it as co-living. Who cares if they screw up the reno? We can get it renovated, in the future anyway. We would have been in a much better off position. Not had to pay a dollar. If anything, we would actually been making money from it, from the co-living.
Yeah.
And today we would have had a $3 million property, a valuation of $3 million property now just sitting there.
Yeah.
So where the loss happened, yes, the loss was selling it, but the gain was it taught me how to get into co-living.
Yeah.
Okay. And from there spiraled out many properties, not just for myself, but for my clients, on how to strategically, strategize a plan for co-living and get into capital cities where they're usually negatively, or not usually, they are negatively geared, and make them into, if they're not neutral, they're positive.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that was a loss and a win at the same time.
It became a longer term win because
it did.
You probably pivoted your strategy after that into coding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Long term, it will work out better because of that lesson.
Yeah.
You know.
There
you go.
You could have also learned by doing it, but.
I know. Hey, come on. But anyway, so that's lesson learned, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what all of them are. Whether they're wins or losses, they're still lessons.
Yeah.
And therefore, they're all wins.
Yeah. And look, it wasn't a loss where we lost money, which was, you know, that's a positive. When you come to a certain level of, knowledge and experience in life when it comes to investing, you know, I could talk about many losses that I've had when I first started.
Yeah. But even then, you were breaking even.
I was breaking even.
I think to really create a material loss in property, something catastrophic has to happen in the sense that you've bought too isolated, or something that's riddled with maintenance or building defects issues or something like that.
Yeah.
I think 9 times out of 10, if you've done a fair amount of due diligence, it's very difficult to lose money.
Yeah.
Unless you're impatient and you buy and sell too quickly and your profits are eaten up by transaction costs.
Yep.
But if you purchase for the right reasons and you hold for long enough, it's actually quite difficult to lose money in property, I think.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. And it's, you know, that story that I just said, the importance of having a mentor as well. So now my uncle wasn't a mentor. He never really was because he was just, he's just not that type of person. I wouldn't, you know. But just by having a mentor and getting, you know, getting their advice and understanding why are they telling me to do this is extremely important, you know. And if not a mentor, well, you can always come to us.
This reminds me of another story. Have I got time for one more story?
Go for it. Go for it.
So speaking of mentors, I've got a cousin who comes to me and asks me property questions, and I helped her purchase her first investment property 3, 4, 5 years ago. And at that time I went with her and inspected it with her, and, you know, but she did the negotiations and she did all that, and I would just sort of mentor her but not do it for her.
Yep.
She's now recently gotten married. I hope she doesn't mind me telling this story, but I love it. And her and her husband wanted to buy their first home, and they each had an investment property before meeting each other, and they wanted to buy something to live in, whether that meant selling one or both of their existing properties or buying this one. They'd found something. Actually, I sent them something that they liked. I had to slip that in there. I sent them something. And they just happened to be really lucky that no one else wanted this property, so they had sort of open slather with the negotiations. And I was coaching them on how to negotiate because I'm like, there's no urgency. There's no other buyers. Why don't you guys practice your negotiating skills?
Yep.
So we had this group chat, and we would have to pump up her husband every time he rang the real estate agent, and we'd have to like give him scripts and what to say, and if the agent says this, say that back, and hold firm on this, and, you know, we'd sort of coach him, and I'd coach them and whatever. And the agent, I think the agent cottoned on that he was being coached, because when he'd meet him at the open homes, he's this really lovely, softly spoken guy. But then on the phone, we'd pump him up to be like a bulldog on the phone.
Yep.
So after they did the deal, and they got a great price and, you know, did a really good deal, the real estate agent goes, "All right, drop the crap. Who was coaching you?"
Okay.
And we laugh about that because he's like, someone was helping you. It was obvious.
Yeah.
And they ended up, the agent ended up going, you did really well. He was like pumping him up. I was like, you did really well. You negotiated quite well. You know, you've done really good. And the agent sort of became a bit of someone that looks out for them a bit now, because he could see that they were first home buyers or first PPLR buyers, but learning the ropes on negotiating.
Yep.
So mentoring, it's very rewarding for the mentor as well, because you get to see these little growth stories. And I love when an agent says, "All right, who was helping you?" Or like, I love when the curtain drops at the end.
Yep.
You know, your enemies up until the contract is signed, and then when you all shake hands, you all say what you really thought.
Yep.
And I love saying to agents, I would have paid 50 grand more just to ruffle their feathers a bit.
Yeah. I say that. So it's especially the ones that piss me off.
Yeah.
You know, they're the ones that I like to throw in. I would have been this much if, yeah.
I still do. Especially if you befriend. I'm really good at befriending agents after dealing with them, because I have to tell them.
Yeah.
I have to go, no, I won this round.
Yeah. That's so funny. That's good fun. All right, let's wrap it up. Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you. I love storytelling.
It's a good one. We'll have some more of these wins and losses.
We need to rack up a few more first.
For sure, 100%. Anybody out there who wants to jump on and have a chat with us, we are offering a 15-minute discovery call. Just head over to propertysession.com.au/15 or the link below.